This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wahib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's really going to be the final washing machine that will help us cleanse the state and identify those who have committed and perpetrated wrong things.
That's South African President Cyril Ramaphosa testifying before a special commission investigating graft under former President Jacob Zuma. Details coming up. Also, U.S. President Joe Biden is sending special envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, to Ethiopia. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Electoral Commission of Zambia is urging candidates of the just-concluded polls to have patience as the electoral body compiles results from all the country's 10 provinces. There was a massive voter turnout at polling stations across the country, including the capital Lusaka. This despite concerns the deployment of heavy security, including the police, military and paramilitary groups, would deter opposition supporters from voting. VOA's Peter Cloti in the Zambian capital Lusaka has this report.
Zambia election officials say they will announce the outcome of Thursday's elections within 72 hours after the last citizen voted late in the night. Electoral Commission spokesperson Patricia Luhanga says the commission is pleased with the large turnout.
The numbers we've seen are quite unprecedented. And for us as a commission, this gives us a sense of pride because we look at the total number of registered voters that is slightly above 7 million. And we look at the queues that we've experienced on poll day, and we have nothing but a sense of pride.
Some voters began standing in line at the polling stations around 1 a.m. Thursday, 5 hours before voting began. Cholwe Hapondela was among those who were in line hours early at the Kapulunga Boys Secondary School polling station in Lusaka. Election officials said some people had slept at the school to ensure their place in line.
Actually, I didn't sleep. I've been waiting for this day for the past 5 years, and I'm glad it's here today. Well, I just want to exercise my rights as a youth. I'm very excited about this one.
Lucky Kawaya was not put off by the long queue at Vera Chiluba Primary School Polling Center in Lusaka.
If you register to vote, there's no reason why you shouldn't vote. Just join the queue, vote, and make your leaders. Choose your leaders. Nobody else will choose your leaders for you.
Analysts had expressed concern about potential violence during the elections. Clashes between supporters of the governing Patriotic Front, or PF, and partisans of the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND Alliance, left two people dead in one constituency in Lusaka earlier this month. The violence, officials say, led to the deployment of the military to that constituency to help maintain law and order. The Electoral Commission also imposed campaign bans in the constituency. It, however, lifted the restriction after the military was sent to other parts of the city to keep the peace. Thursday's general election was mostly peaceful, despite reports of violence in parts of the country. The Electoral Commission's Luhanga says at least one person died during voting.
It's quite interesting, really, that despite most of the country being peaceful, we have received reports of violence, specifically in the southern province of Zambia, as well as northwestern province. And unfortunately for northwestern province, we have recorded a death. This, we are working closely with Zambia police to establish what happened. And because it's a criminal nature, we'll have to have Zambia police deal with it holistically.
Officials of the African Union Poll Observer Mission said the process was peaceful. Representatives of political parties at the polling stations they visited, they say, had no problems and were pleased with how the elections were administered. Former Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma, who led the AU observers, told VOA he was pleased with how Zambians behaved during voting. Kuruma commended the patience and decorum of the large crowds at the polling stations he visited. He also praised the professionalism of the Electoral Commission staff at the polling stations as well as the police there to maintain the peace. Before Election Day, Kuruma met with many stakeholders, including incumbent President Edgar Lungu, his main rival Hakainde Hichilema, other presidential candidates, civil society and religious groups. He called on the candidate to accept the outcome of Thursday's vote.
We have cautioned them, even those that have concerns, they will address the concerns. It's all part of building the democratic process. We will continue to engage, but the concerns should not cause anybody to reject the outcome. There are constitutional methods to adopt if you are in disagreement with the outcome.
The Electoral Commission says results from urban areas have begun trickling in. Officials say they will give regular updates to keep the country informed about the vote counting process. Election analysts say they expect the results of the presidential election to be declared this weekend. However, if none of the 16 presidential candidates capture more than 50% of the vote, there will be a runoff. For VOA, I'm Peter Clotty reporting from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
U.S. President Joe Biden is sending his special envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, to Ethiopia. In announcing the trip, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan urged Ethiopia's government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, to come to the negotiating table after 9 months of conflict that has killed thousands and created a humanitarian crisis in one of the world's poorest regions. Reuters reports that there was no immediate comment from Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's spokesperson on Envoy Feltman's visit. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has concluded his testimony at the commission investigating state corruption, admitting that his party members and government officials have been at the center of the rot. Witnesses have linked them to graft over the past 2 years, with some already in the courts. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In his two-day testimony, Ramaphosa admitted that the so-called state capture effort that largely happened under the leadership of former President Jacob Zuma was the country's biggest threat. The commission wanted to know why, as Zuma's deputy and leader of government business, he did nothing about it.
They had ensconced themselves quite neatly into the various structures. They had protection, they had approval, and they had access.
He told the commission that if he had tried to directly confront Zuma on some of his appointments meant to facilitate corruption, he would have been sacked. The commission pushed him further to know why then did he not resign if he did not want to be part of the rot.
This action of resignation would have significantly impaired my ability to contribute to bring about what I would call an end to state capture.
Political analyst Prince Mashele disagrees.
Where did it help South Africa? The answer is, Cyril Ramaphosa did not help South Africa, did not arrest the looting. He was there and smiling and praising Jacob Zuma, period.
With several party leaders and former and current cabinet members largely in the party faction supporting Zuma, heavily implicated in most of the state looting, Ramaphosa admitted the ANC stands as the top suspect. Political analyst Stephen Friedman says Ramaphosa's resolve to deal with corrupt party members was disarmed by infighting and internal factional backlist.
The National Executive Committee split just about equally between the two factions. He took the view that he had to conciliate the other faction rather than alienate them. And at times, he did this incredibly effectively. But he didn't always get it right.
Though Ramaphosa now has all the power he needs to act against corrupt ANC members, analysts say he is still treading carefully, seeing that he needs more friends than foes when he runs for re-election. But Ramaphosa says his party has already asked all those facing allegations of corruption to step aside, including suspended party secretary general Ace Mahashule.
Our task now, as we move forward, the commission is really going to be the final washing machine that will help us cleanse the state and identify those who have committed and perpetrated wrong things.
Looting of state funds and resources through misuse of funds and irregularly issued government contracts is estimated to be running into billions of dollars. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi surprised Egyptians when he announced it's time to increase the price of a loaf of bread. Changes to food subsidies are highly sensitive in a country where a decision to cut bread subsidies led to deadly riots in 1977. Observers said the new move would test the silence and patience of Egyptians who have kept quiet about other price hikes, and that the issue of bread could be a ticking time bomb. Amin Saeed, an Egyptian public opinion analyst, discussed the possibility of bread protests with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The trouble with such analysis is that they take the historical precedent of 1977 when the IMF agreement led to the surprise hike in the prices of bread and many foodstuffs, and so people exploded. At that time, we had political parties that were active in the street, especially the left, and they controlled the trade unions, and they were active. And so there was a big riots that led in the end to the government ending all those measures and back to normalcy. So price of oil and electricity and a lot of other things had been jumping and nothing happened. You had the Nile issue. There were many calls by opposition abroad for people to take an action. There was a call for a revolt on the Nile in June and also in July, and maybe another call also on Twitter in September, and so far nothing happened. And that's why the government felt that the agreement with IMF is very important. People also fear the alternative. They cannot jump into the unknown. They see the Middle East is full of disturbances and very unstable these days. And jumping into the unknown puts a lot of fear into the minds of Egyptians. And so nobody is moving, despite the fact that they may be objecting and do not like it. But at the same time, they feel that the price can be high and they don't want to pay it now. And that's why there was this kind of acceptance and only noise in the social media that comes from abroad.
Sisi's government has turned to the IMF, which granted a $12 billion loan in 2016 and a one-year $5.2 billion loan last year. But the IMF specified that food subsidies should only reach those most in need and also required higher fuel and electricity prices as an economic reform. Could protest laws in Egypt limit the prospects of the once common street demonstrations, thus allowing President Sisi to quietly pass his economic reform plans?
The Egyptians have tried demonstration and revolution twice in the last decade, 2011, 2013, and things got worse than before. And so I don't think that it is a problem of law and security. I mean, there was law and security in 2011, and Egyptians revolted against Mubarak for 18 days and toppled them. So it's not a question of fear. If the people really felt that there is hope and that demonstration and revolution would lead to a better future, then they would have demonstrated and they would have broken any culture of fear. But because they feel that there is nothing gonna come out of that, and they feel that their country is the only country in the Middle East that is achieving economic growth and stability despite corona that is hitting the area and terrorism and trouble in the whole area in general, they just feel that let's wait and see how things will end up in the future.
Egypt's bread subsidy program amounts to about 48 billion Egyptian pounds and it's available to some 70 million Egyptians. However, the government has been criticized for not being effective enough in reducing poverty in Egypt. The government is trying to secure 8 billion Egyptian pounds to fund school meals, which will be distributed in the coming new school year. Would such a program calm the Egyptian public opinion regarding the hike in bread price?
The government sold this decision to raise the price of bread under the slogan that they will channel the money to school children, which nobody would object. And that's why it would pass, I think.
That was Amin Saeed, an Egyptian public opinion analyst, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and here is a recap of our top stories. The Electoral Commission of Zambia is calling for patience as it compiles results from Thursday's presidential election. And U.S. President Joe Biden is sending his special envoy for the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, to Ethiopia. Thanks for listening to VOA Africa. And for more news and information, visit our website at voanews.com. A press release indicates that 3 million doses of United Kingdom-donated AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccines are arriving in countries across Africa, including Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Malawi, Senegal, and Egypt. British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab said this is the first batch of 80 million being donated via COVAX facility, adding, "No one is safe until everyone is safe." Doctors in Nigeria are on strike over unpaid salaries and poor benefits. The strike by some 40% of the medical workforce comes amid a fresh wave of coronavirus infections, severely straining the country's health care system. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Anap's Sarah Igwe is visiting Abuja's National Hospital for a post-surgery appointment for a second time since the National Association of Resident Doctors, or NARD, began their strike on July 2nd. The 62-year-old underwent surgery last month to address bleeding in his colon. He says he was unable to see a doctor during his first visit last week and is hoping to get lucky this time round.
I did a laboratory test. The results were out. But because I was no doctor, I have to wait for a whole week until yesterday when I got there. I have to wait for a long, long time.
NARD, which represents about 40% of Nigeria's medical workforce, is protesting unpaid salaries and what the association says are poor working conditions and benefits for its members. The doctors' union is also accusing Nigeria's health authorities of falling short on promises made earlier this year to meet these demands. Those promises led the group to call off a strike in April after a 10-day walkout. Jerry Isogun, Secretary General of the Association, says their patience is at an end.
Enough is enough. While we understand the peculiarity of the time we are in, we also know that the same government is attending to other issues. So we are calling the attention to the health sector. Let us prioritize the health sector.
However, the latest strike is raising concerns as Nigeria confronts a third wave of the coronavirus triggered by the deadly Delta variant. Last Wednesday, the country reported over 700 new cases of the coronavirus, the highest daily rate in many months, signaling a third wave is in full swing. Health authorities say the strike is ill-timed and will have consequences. Health Board Director Ndayo Iwat says the medical salary issues is complicated and does not solely rest on health authorities.
When just like minimum wage, because that's how the federal government is looking at it, minimum wage that, the minimum wage for the federation is so-so-so, so states should be able to take that up and appear accordingly, but so that they don't have the capacity to vote.
NART says doctors will remain on strike unless all their demands are met. Meanwhile, this week, the Medical and Dental Consultants Association of Nigeria, MDCAN, also threatened to go on strike by Monday over remuneration for its members. This is bad news for patients like Sarah Igbe and Nigeria's already stretched public health system. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Sudan and the International Criminal Court, ICC, signed a cooperation deal yesterday to pave the way for former dictator Omar al-Bashir to face trial for genocide in the Darfur conflict. The French news agency AFP says Bashir has been wanted by the ICC for more than a decade on charges of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in the Sudan region. Two other former top officials are also facing ICC war crime charges: ex-defense minister Abdul Rahim Mohamed Hussein and Ahmed Haroun, a former governor of Sudan's South Kordofan state. Earlier this week, Sudan's cabinet agreed to hand over Bashir and the other wanted officials, a decision that still needs the approval of the ruling Sovereign Council, comprised of military and civilian figures. Militants in Mali have massacred more than 50 villagers near the borders with Burkina Faso and Niger. The area has seen increasing violence from armed Islamists, and activists are calling on authorities to act. Annie Reisenberg reports from Bamako.
Militants attacked three villages in northern Mali simultaneously this past Sunday, leaving more than 50 civilians dead and several injured. The neighboring villages of Karu, Wataguna, and Dautageft are in an area near the borders with Niger and Burkina Faso that has seen increasing, often deadly violence the past few years. Al-Mahdi Cisse is a coordinator of the collective Songhoi Chawarabatu, a group of organizations representing the Songhoi people, who make up most of the inhabitants of the Gao region, where the attacks occurred. He said through a messaging application from Bamako, the assailants shot at everything that moved, including those leaving the mosques and those returning to the village from the fields. Chawarabatu has called on the Malian government and the international community to secure the area and to disarm militants in a release statement. We can't understand how a locality like Karu, like Wataguna, he says, where the military camps are not even 18 kilometers away, that massacres are happening and there are not reinforcements. There are no prosecutions. We do not understand. Since a Tuareg rebellion and coup in 2012, Mali has seen both chronic political instability and increasing Islamist violence. Ali Ntine, an independent UN expert on human rights in Mali, said through a messaging application from Dakar that Islamist groups are exploiting local mineral resources, mostly gold, and are able to finance themselves. With funds and control of the local area, which is largely inaccessible by the state, they gain credibility among the local population. In reality, he says, we have, little by little, a state within the state, or two states within the state, and that is a real threat for the Malian state, for the survival of the Malian state. Mali's neighbors, Niger and Burkina Faso, are also plagued by violence from Islamist groups. The same day of the attacks in the Gao region, suspected jihadists attacked Burkinabe troops near Mali's border. 30 civilians were also killed in attacks in northern Burkina Faso last week. Tin says the Sahel needs a regional strategy, focused on all of the affected countries in the Sahel and West Africa. The problem isn't just Mali, he says. We can't just fix Mali with a national security response. We can't do this for Burkina Faso nor Niger. He says what must be made is a regional strategy, with Africans that will cover the region and who are supported. This is important. Supported by the international community. VOA attempted to talk to Malian authorities for this story, but they did not make themselves available for comment. Elections in Mali are scheduled for February 2022. Tin says the insecurity in Mali's center and north remains the top priority for the transitional government. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.